the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. California's joining of the Super Tuesday primary party has made the Golden State a political heavyweight. Candidates have been campaigning up and down for delegates, but they're not just hugging the coast. This time, they're hoping to plant seeds of support in the Central Valley. Plus, from pro football player to Oscar-winning filmmaker with the help of an L.A. nonprofit. That and a lot more is all coming up on Take Two. Stick around. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for joining us today, and here's hoping that your three-day weekend glow has not worn off quite yet. Coming up on the show, one California lawmaker is looking for an official apology from the state legislature for its role in the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. We'll hear about why this matters coming up. Plus, former NFL player Matthew Cherry talks to us about his Oscar win for his animated short, Hair Love.
You know, back in 2017, I came across a lot of these videos of black dads that were doing their daughter's hair, and it felt like a really great opportunity to kind of normalize black fathers.
That's coming up toward the end of the show, so be sure to stay with us. But first, we're going to hit the campaign trail. Now, while this week's spotlight is on the Nevada caucus coming up on Saturday, for many with a stake in the game, California's March 3rd primary is growing in importance. So getting out there as a candidate in the Golden State has really been a high priority, and not just in the cash-crusted coastal areas such as San Francisco and Los Angeles. No, this time around, the presidential candidates are making sure that the farm regions of California's Central Valley feel their love with hopes of getting some of that love back in the form of delegates. Carla Marinucci has been reporting on this for Politico's California Playbook. Carla, welcome back.
Hey.
You're so synonymous with California, I almost merged Carla and California all together into one new name.
That's very kind of you.
Now, just to set the stage here, I want to talk about the first person you quote in your story, someone named, and I hope I'm saying this right, Kathy Causey, is that her name?
Correct, yes.
Causey, okay. Now, she's a retired Child Protective Services worker, lifelong Democrat. Where does she live, and what did she have to say?
Yeah, she lives out in Twain Heart, way out there in rural California, and I met up with her in Turlock at the Valentine's Day gala dinner at the Assyrian American Civics Club, not the place that you expect to see a major presidential candidate coming off a big win in Iowa and a strong showing in New Hampshire. That would be Pete Buttigieg, but Buttigieg was out there in Turlock this last weekend, mining for votes in California. It just goes to show you've got 53 congressional districts here, and that means this is like a primary in 53 different states. These candidates need to pick up delegates, and they were out there talking to people like Kathy, hoping to get support.
Yeah, and what did she have? I mean, had she ever seen a presidential candidate before?
That was a fascinating thing. I mean, this is a lifelong Democrat, somebody who's been active in the party for her whole life, said she had never seen a presidential candidate in her life. There are many Californians like that. She was ready to drive to Reno to see Tom Steyer just for the thrill of it.
Wow.
But now it seems like, you know, the people out in the Central Valley and other areas near the Mojave Desert, they're not going to have to travel that far. The candidates are coming to them in search of delegates, in search of support, and that's what it's going to come down to in the California primary.
And you give us a little hint of that, because there's a lot of places to visit. So what is it about California's primary rules that has all the hopefuls scouring the state?
Within each of these 53 congressional districts, the delegates, there's about 5 to 7 in each district, are going to be awarded proportionally. This is not a winner-take-all. So that means moderate candidates, for instance, like a Buttigieg, like a Michael Bloomberg, have a chance in areas that maybe Trump won in the last election. That would be parts of the Central Valley. There are, you know, about 20 different congressional districts out there that have a chance for a pickup for them. So they are out there trolling around, and Bloomberg is paying big money out there. He's hiring lots of folks, and they're looking for the Latino vote. That's very critical. He's got a new ad campaign running that's going to reach millions of these voters out in the Central Valley. That's what Pablo Espinosa, his new outreach, Latino outreach director, told us. And Espinosa is an example of the kind of people Bloomberg is hiring to reach rural areas of the state. He was the longtime media advisor for the California State Assembly and a Univision journalist, well known. And now he's one of the people that are trolling for Bloomberg out there in the Central Valley and other areas. So I think, you know, this is a new game for these Democrats as they compete against each other, and they need to go every part of the state to pick up as many delegates as they can.
They're really running that ground game. Then you mentioned 53 different areas to do it in. So that explains Kathy's observation, or that's why she was so shocked to see Pete Buttigieg. But is the delegate juice worth a campaigning squeeze here?
You know, I think this is the question. There are, you know, I just saw Bernie Sanders yesterday here in Richmond, which is one of the most liberal areas of the Bay Area of the country, by the way, in the East Bay. He had about 10,000 people show up to see him there. That's an easy pickup for Bernie Sanders, and so are many of the urban areas. But when you're talking about a race that could come down to, people are talking about a contested convention, every one of these delegates is going to matter in California, because we have 494 at stake here. That's 10 times what was at stake in Iowa. So they know this is a mother load, and they have a chance to get a big part of those riches here in the rural areas of California.
So it's really like taking that 3-point shot in a way. Why take a lot of 2-pointers when you can get one that'll get you more than one of those other shots would?
Yeah, absolutely right. And that's why Tom Steyer, for instance, has opened an office in the Antelope Valley. That's on the edge of the Mojave Desert. You've got people fighting for the endorsement of mayors in Dinuba and Lemoore. These are way out there communities in the Central Valley. Those two mayors have both gone to Bloomberg. You've got mayors in Fresno. I mean, this is where Fresno, by the way, has been a must visit, it seems like, for many of the candidates. We've seen Bloomberg out there, Bernie Sanders a number of times. Buttigieg has been out there. He had a town hall meeting with Chris Matthews of Hardball out there. So these are areas that are finally getting recognized, and people are saying it's about time.
But Carl, it seems to me that an Iowa Democrat may be a bit or a lot more different than, say, a California Democrat, depending on where they are. So how specific to the audience are the candidates' talking points sounding like?
You know, they are speaking very closely with regard to issues. When I heard Buttigieg out there, he was talking about farm issues, about jobs and the economy. This is a big issue out in rural California, because the unemployment rates are very, very high out in the Central Valley. And believe it or not, climate change has a big appeal to many of the voters out there, because the air quality is some of the worst in the state, and water issues, drinkable water, are very big issues. Many of those environmental issues relate back to climate change. Of course, the Latino vote, the fastest growing electorate in California. That's an area where Bernie Sanders has been very, very successful, but certainly Bloomberg wants a piece of that action. That's why he's hiring people like Pablo Espinosa and getting some of those mayors out in the Latino-heavy Central Valley hamlets, places that are just flyovers. Some of them are hardly bigger than gas stations, but they are part of congressional districts that's in some cases flipped, like the 10th congressional district, which flipped from Republican to Democrat last time around. And so you've got moderate voters out there, or those NPP voters, and that's where Bernie Sanders is making a very big play for them. Yesterday, he made the pitch that they need to ask for a Democratic ballot to vote in the presidential campaign. And Bloomberg is telling all of these voters, vote early. They want to bank those votes early in California. And of course, you can vote now in the Super Tuesday primary. And I think a lot of the campaigns are seeing that is going to be their ace in the hole when it comes to March 3rd.
And we got some voting information coming up in the very next segment, just a few minutes from now. So everyone stay tuned for that. One more thing, Carla, they're not going to ignore L.A. completely, right? I mean, we've seen how L.A. is D.C.'s political ATM.
No, you're absolutely right. In fact, in about an hour and a half, President Trump is going to be landing in L.A., so watch that traffic down there. But he's doing exactly that, going to the ATM in Los Angeles before tomorrow, going out to the rural areas in Bakersfield to talk with Kevin McCarthy to give him a boost to be the next speaker. That's what he says. The ATMs of California, Silicon Valley, Bay Area, and Los Angeles, always going to be important. But now these candidates are adding new itineraries to the agenda.
Carla Marinucci of Politico's California Playbook. Carla, thanks a lot.
Good to be with you.
All right, staying with politics, every Tuesday we're inviting you to Voter Game Plan Central. You see, in the KPCC newsroom, we have a whole team of question-answering democracy elves to help you navigate this election season. Well, actually, they're very hardworking producers, reporters, and editors, but democracy elves sounded a lot more fun. And today in studio, we have KPCC's audience engagement editor, Brianna Lee, and politics reporter, Libby Denkman, to fill you in on all you need to know about the March 3rd primary. Hey there.
Hey, A.
Hi.
All right. First up, Brianna, you're tackling an issue related to the new ballot marking machines in L.A. County. So what's going on?
So we've had a few people write in to ask us about the new machines that L.A. County is rolling out in the primary to help mark your ballot. So they're asking, if I don't want to use these voting machines, is there a way I can still vote with traditional ink and paper?
All right, so what are the options?
Well, first off, so we know that some voters have concerns over security with the machines. So we're putting a few reminders out there. Number one, the machines are not connected to the internet, and they don't store any voter data. And number two, you are still technically voting on paper. You're feeding a paper ballot into the machine and then marking your choices on a touchscreen. Then the machine returns your marked paper ballot and you review it and you submit. But if you're still uncomfortable using the machines, that's totally fine and you have options. The easiest thing to do is request a vote by mail ballot. The deadline to do that is February 25th, so you still have time. Otherwise, if you're voting in person, you can request a hand marked ballot at your voting center. But it's not going to be the easiest process. You're going to get mostly a blank ballot and you'll have to write down which office you're voting for, as well as the name of the candidate. And so if you're going to do that, you should definitely bring your sample ballot because you'll need to refer back to it a lot. So bottom line, if the machines are an issue for you, try to get a vote by mail ballot.
And just a reminder, like Brianna said, that deadline is coming up. It's just a week from today, February 25th.
All right, February 25th, big deadline. All right, today, Libby, is another big deadline for voters, though.
That's right. February 18th, today, is the regular registration deadline. So it's the last day to register online for this primary election. However, this date doesn't really mean as much as it once did because folks can still register to vote in person at a county election office or at any vote center or polling place up to and including Election Day. That's across California. Vote centers start to open on Saturday in Los Angeles and Orange County. We've got info online about how to find one near you. That's at las.com/elections. And a note, if you do register after today, that's the 15-day registration deadline, you'll likely fill out a same-day or conditional registration form, and you'll probably use a provisional ballot.
Provisional ballot. Can you explain that whole provisional ballot thing? Because there are a lot of conspiracies online and social media about how they're just going to wind up in the trash or something like that.
Yeah, it is kind of crazy. So just listen to my words right now. Provisional ballots do not get thrown away. They are a great safety net for voters in California, and that we're really lucky to have so many ways to vote in this state. Provisional ballots are just regular ballots that are put into provisional envelopes. In LA, those are pink envelopes. The only difference is that they go through this extra processing step to confirm a voter's eligibility, that they're registered and that they haven't already voted before that ballot is tabulated. But they are tabulated. A last election in 2018, Los Angeles counted close to 95% of them. In Orange County, it was 90%. And there's also a ballot tracker tool online where you can see what happens to your ballot, including when your provisional ballot is counted. So there's a lot of transparency there. California takes a long time to count votes, in part because we use more of these provisional ballots than many other states. The state and county election officials really try everything possible to count every vote.
And I understand from your reporting on Elias that there are a new law that impacts voting in California.
Yes, that is SB 207. It was passed earlier this month and signed by the governor last week. It simplifies the process of changing political parties up to and including Election Day. And changing parties really used to be quite clunky. Voters had to fill out a whole new registration form, which could slow things down and create lines on Election Day. If people swapped parties within the 15 days before an election, they had to register conditionally and use a provisional ballot. But now voters get to use this simplified form to swap parties or update their address. And that makes it quicker and easier to participate in the presidential primary of their choice and usually helps avoid the extra processing step of that provisional ballot. And this lets people more easily get the ballot that they want on Election Day.
We're talking to KPCC's audience engagement editor, Brianna Lee, and politics reporter, Libby Denkman. Now, Libby, you've been covering another very sticky issue. No party preference voters in this state must ask for a Democratic ballot to weigh in on that that party's presidential primary, right?
I really don't think we can say this enough. If you are a no party preference voter and you vote by mail, if you want to vote for president, you have to ask for a Democratic ballot. Republicans don't allow crossover votes. To vote for GOP, you have to change parties, which is easier now, as we just discussed. And asking for that crossover ballot is really no problem in person. You can simply ask election workers for one when you check in. But for vote-by-mail folks, you must request a Democratic ballot to be mailed to you by a week from today. That's the 25th, the deadline that we talked about earlier. Polling shows that the majority of no-party preference voters want to vote in the Democratic primary. There's a variety of possible reasons for this. I mean, it's a more exciting race this year, of course. Maybe these voters lean to the left, even though they identify as independent. But the number of people right now who have actually asked for that crossover ballot is extremely low. It's under 10% in most counties. In LA, it was just 6%, and in Orange County, 7% the last time I checked. So again, no party preference, folks. If you vote by mail and you want to vote in the Democratic primary, you have one more week to request that ballot, the Democratic ballot, if you want to weigh in on this presidential race.
All right, Brianna, you're back up, because now we're going to turn to a question I understand that you're seeing more and more of, and that's voters apparently getting mail-in ballots when they didn't expect it. So what's up with that?
Yeah, so anecdotally, we've been hearing stories about people who've been receiving vote-by-mail ballots even though they didn't request one. So one way that this can happen is if you live in a state assembly or senate or congressional district that overlaps with Orange County. So Orange County is sending mail-in ballots to all registered voters this year, so that might include you. Or if you recently updated your driver's license, there's a box on the DMV form that opts you in to get a vote by mail ballot too. So that's another possibility. But if these scenarios don't apply to you and you still got a vote by mail ballot, well, we want to hear from you. We're curious to know how many people might be experiencing this. So if you want to let us know, you can email our voter game plan team at elections@kpcc.org. Again, that's elections@kpcc.org.
That's Brianna Lee and Libby Denkman. Thanks a lot, you two.
Thanks, A.
Thanks.
And just in case you're wondering if this info is really getting through to folks, listen to this voicemail we got from a listener the other day.
Hi, my name is Aisha Mason, and I heard your segment yesterday about changes in voting in L.A. County. As a result of your show, I got online and I did research. I called the L.A. County Voter Registrar Office, and I've made a voting guide that I'm posting on Facebook and sending to all my email lists so that people know about the changes and don't get caught off guard. Thank you so much for the episode. I consider myself pretty politically savvy, and I had no idea all those changes were taking place. Thank you.
That's KPCC listener Aisha Mason. So there you have it. Aisha, thanks for calling in. All right, from state and national politics to a local race, there are three people vying to be District Attorney of Los Angeles County. The two challengers are former San Francisco DA George Gascon and former public defender Rachel Rossi. Last week, we brought you profiles for both of them, and now we shift to the person who's had the job since 2012, the first woman and African-American to serve as LA's DA, the incumbent Jackie Lacey. She's next when Take 2 continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. The March primary, as we keep telling you, is right around the corner. And the presidential primary is not the only big race to think about. KPCC's Emily Elena Dugdale has been profiling the three candidates running for Los Angeles County District Attorney. Now, so far, we've met the two challengers, former San Francisco DA George Gascon and former public defender Rachel Rossi. Today, Emily profiles the incumbent, and that's DA Jackie Lacey.
I. State your name.
Jackie Lacey.
Surrounded by her family, Jackie Lacey was sworn into office in 2012 as the first woman and first Black person to serve as LA County DA. Celebrities like Magic Johnson showered her with praise. But 8 years later, Lacey is in the political fight of her life against two reformist challengers. She's an LA native. Lacey grew up in the Crenshaw District. Her parents had left the South for Southern California, hoping to leave its racism behind.
They taught my sister and I, Carol,
a lot about what it was like for them to grow up in a segregated society, how they wanted better for us. They wanted a college education opportunity.
Lacey's father was a sanitation worker, her mother a cook for the LA Unified School District. She says they taught her the importance of public service. Lacey has worked in the DA's office since 1986. As she rose through the ranks, she headed, among other things, the Major Crimes and Major Narcotics Unit. Lacey's politics challenge many people's assumptions about what a Black politician looks like. She's a moderate. Lacey describes herself as
a reasonable reformer. I'm not part of the old guard.
But her critics say she's not doing enough to dismantle racism in the criminal justice system. Lacey says that's unfair.
As DA, your true north is justice, right? You have got to be someone who cares about victims and protecting your community. On the other hand, you've got to balance that with fairness, recognizing that there are people in the justice system who deserve a break, a chance to re-enter.
She points to her work establishing a special unit to help people with mental health issues get treatment and avoid jail time. Increasing opportunities for diversion is a cornerstone of Lacey's re-election platform, along with bail reform and combating sexual violence. The unions representing the rank and file at the LAPD and the Sheriff's Department have endorsed Lacey. So has the union for LA's deputy district attorneys. Its vice president is Eric Siddall.
I think there is a perception that she is a hard-charging DA who wants everyone locked up, and that's just not the case.
But Lacey's critics say in a lot of ways she does resemble a traditional tough-on-crime prosecutor. They point to her opposition to Prop 47, which reduced a number of nonviolent felonies to misdemeanors. Lacey says Prop 47 was poorly conceived and has led to a surge in property crimes. Both of Lacey's opponents attack her for continuing to pursue the death penalty in some cases. They say it's inherently racist. Every person sentenced to death during Lacey's tenure has been a person of color. Lacey says race isn't a factor.
We're not out there choosing people based on their color. People are choosing to come on our radar because they commit crimes. And that's the end of the story. People are making some very bad choices.
Lacey has taken the most heat over police shootings. She's only prosecuted one cop for shooting a civilian while on duty. Black Lives Matter has held a weekly protest outside Lacey's office for years.
This is the people versus Jackie Lacey, yes?
Yes!
In 2018, the group took its protest to Lacey's home in Granada Hills. As police officers lined the street, activists set up a projector, and the words, "Jackie Lacey must go," appeared on the front of her house.
We are the people!
Black Lives Matter co-founder Melina Abdullah spoke on the sidewalk.
Well, guess what? After a year of protest in front of her office, now we taking it to your house. Jackie, there is nowhere for you to go.
Nope.
Where the people will not be.
Lacey defends her record on police shootings.
It's not that we are pro-police or anti-police. It's that we're looking at the facts and following the law.
Lacey says her office has met privately with parents of several people killed by police. Melina Abdullah says Black Lives Matter has repeatedly asked for a public meeting with Lacey, which the DA has refused to do. So Lacey will continue to face protesters as she campaigns for a third term as DA, while she continues to make the case that she's a reasonable reformer. Covering public safety, I'm Emily Elena Dugdale.
And you can check out Emily's profiles of all three candidates and learn a lot more about the DA race at laist.com. That's laist.com. All right, moving on. On February 19th, 1942, President Franklin Roosevelt signed Executive Order No. 9066, which ordered the internment of tens of thousands of Japanese Americans throughout the western United States. As part of this Thursday's Day of Remembrance commemoration, California State Assemblyman Al Maratsuchi will be introducing a resolution, an official apology by the California Assembly for the legislative actions at the time. And with us to talk about the importance and impact of this move is Susan Kamei, lecturer at the USC Department of History. Susan, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you.
Wondering, okay, has the federal government acknowledged the mistakes made back in 1942?
Yes. Congress passed and President Ronald Reagan signed Civil Liberties Act of 1988, which was based on recommendations from a congressional commission that found that there was no military necessity for the forced removal and detention of 120,000 persons of Japanese ancestry. And as part of that act, issued an official apology and provided some token reparations payment for the then surviving incarcerees.
And since then, other public officials have done the same thing, right, in those years since?
You mean the individuals that were part of the decision to...
Well, what I mean is other public officials since then have also expressed the same kind of remorse.
Sure. Uh-huh.
Now, I'm wondering then, how does Assemblyman Maratsuchi's resolution differ from previous efforts to apologize and correct past mistakes?
Sure. Well, this is by the... California legislature, assuming this resolution passes, that the state of California itself was a major player in the the hysteria that led to the political pressure for the issuance of Executive Order 9066, and that the California legislature itself, as outlined in the text of the resolution, passed various legislative acts along the way, the California alien land laws, dismissing, having the state personnel board dismiss state employees, and so forth. And so there were official actions by the state of California that affected the majority of those who were forcibly removed were residents of the state.
So this could, in some ways, Susan, localize what was seen maybe from a 30,000-foot view as a federal thing?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Now, you have a very personal connection to the story. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, both my dad's family and my mother and her parents were among those who were incarcerated. My mother and her parents were first sent to the Santa Anita Assembly Center and then on to Heart Mountain, Wyoming. And then my dad's family that were from Orange County went directly to the Poston, Arizona camp. And my dad, when he was alive, was a community leader in the Japanese American organizations. And then he and I were very involved in the what we call the redress movement that was in support of the Civil Liberties Act of 1988.
It sounded like it completely shaped the course of your life, Susan.
Yes, it did. Yes, it has.
Yeah. Did you ever look back? I mean, how did you look back on it? A clinical way in terms of researching it and understanding it, or because of your personal connection, was there a lot of emotion involved?
Both. In fact, I was able to do some family history research at the National Archives, and those two roles really, really collided for me. It was a very emotional experience to actually read the files of my family members. I think because I was fortunate to work closely with my father in for many years in the community, both for this issue and then over the years have continued to study and research it, and I have the opportunity to teach about it at the University of Southern California. So it's been very much a commitment of mine to help educate the public about what really happened.
It still, I think, makes a lot of people angry to this day to think of so many Japanese Americans who had businesses that they lost completely and weren't able to get back. Their lives gone, and they had to rebuild from scratch.
That rebuilding, that part of the resettlement is part of the, I think, still untold tragedy of the whole episode.
I'm talking to Susan Kamei, lecturer at the USC Department of History. Now, a few years ago when you taught USC's first ever history course on the Japanese-American internment, you found that a lot of students had really little to no familiarity with the subject. Why do you think it is, and how did that influence how you taught the class?
Yes, sure. I'm not surprised. Most people in general have little or no information or context for what happened, the students today at USC, I think what I like to say is that this opportunity that we have to spend a semester looking at the whole trajectory of the episode gives them frameworks of analysis for making sense of the political issues today. So we use it as a lens, we like to say in history, yeah, for how they might apply this kind of inquiry to to other issues. But they do tell me that they appreciate the opportunity to study the economics, sociological, political, even religious, and other interdisciplinary disciplines in looking at not only what happened, but the ramifications of what happened.
Susan, if you'll indulge me a little bit, I just want to get a little personal considering your story. I have two granddaughters that are Japanese Americans. One is 10 and one is 6. When should I tell them or introduce this to them? Or is it something that I should wait on?
No, please tell them. George Takei has written a graphic novel, and it's oriented to being able to explain the feelings and some of the historical facts about what happened. I think there's lots of ways to help create empathy for what not just happened to the Issei, who were aliens who were not able to become citizens, but also the rights of 70,000, approximately 70,000 Nisei who are American born, and I think the eternal vigilance is carved on the side of the National Archives that's required to protect our liberties is what I think we want our children. Our citizens of the future to be mindful of.
One more thing, Susan, back to the apology. Is it important that this apology comes at a time where there are still people alive who lived through that time?
Yes. Fortunately, there are still a few that are still with us, but unfortunately, so many have now not been able to appreciate this. But I think it's important because so many people don't know about this that we take every opportunity to acknowledge it.
Susan Kamei, lecturer at the USC Department of History. Susan, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, planning a family comes with a lot to carefully consider. First off, can you afford it? Do you and your partner have the mental and physical stamina that having kids will definitely require? Is there enough space where you can add a little but growing new body to where you live? Well, now some couples are adding a question to those questions that really has some global consequences. And when they answer that question, they decide that having kids is really not worth it. Find out what that question is when Take Two continues. Stay with us. All right, lots of news to get to this afternoon. All things considered, the host, Nick Roman, is here. What do you got cooking, Nick?
Well, we've got a follow-up to the investigation that KPCC's Aaron Mendelson did on the landlord Mike Niger and his Palma management firm, the company that maintains his low-rent units. We called it Stuck. A Palma building in San Bernardino caught fire over the weekend. Aaron was out there today doing some reporting, and he's going to join us to talk about what he found. Long Beach Poly High has suspended a teacher who's accused of racist abuse of students. KPCC's Kyle Stokes is looking into that story. And an approach to treating new diseases that worked for the Ebola virus and the Zika virus is now being tested to see if it will work on coronavirus. So you'll hear all those stories on All Things Considered at 4, after Marketplace at 3, and The Frame at 3:30.
My mom was planning a trip to South America, but she just doesn't want to be on a plane now.
Yeah, a lot of people feel exactly that way. It's really going to, and you'll see a lot of that showing up in business numbers within a few months.
All right, that's Nick Roman, All Things Considered. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. There's a growing feeling among millennials, or to be specific, those who are currently in the age range to think about starting a family, that they should not have kids. And the reason is climate change. Danny Blum wrote about this for the New York Times. Danny, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. All right. The fear of catastrophic climate change is the overarching factor here. But what are some of the specific reasons people have cited?
Well, it's twofold. There is, as you mentioned, that really pervasive fear. People are scared that if they do bring children into the world, the future for them will not be so great. The other factor is that having a child does, by some reports, lead to more emissions and, you know, contributes to taking up scarce resources. There was a study in particular from 2017 that found that in developed countries, having one fewer child would result in an average of 58.6 tons of CO2 equivalent emission reductions per year.
All sorts of groups have formed in the U.S., England, and Canada, where people have made a pledge not to have kids. Birth Strike is one of those groups. Can you tell us about that group, how it started, and who's a part of it?
Sure. Birth Strike is probably one of the most prominent ones of these groups. It's based out of England. They have a Facebook group that, by my count this morning, has about 900 members in it. And yeah, they've taken a pledge that they personally have decided not to have children due to what they consider to be the severity of the ecological crisis. It was started by a musician named Blythe Pepino, who lives in England, and she had gone to a lecture by a nonviolent environmental protest group called Extinction Rebellion, and she started really considering the impact that having a child would have on the world and also the world that she would bring a potential child into. And so she started really spreading the word about this movement. It's gotten some additional coverage, and now it has a real global movement and a sense of community.
And there's a sense of this is a moral issue for them, right? I mean, it's just more than just the climate in front of us right now. Morally, they don't want to add to this in the coming years.
Yeah, it's definitely an ethical dilemma that people are wrestling with.
Now, what are some of the other groups out there like this?
There is a group called Conceivable Future, which is a women-led network based in the U.S., and they are really focused on gathering testimonies about climate change and reproductive choices. They consider climate change to be a reproductive justice issue, in part because some of the people in groups like this feel like they don't have the choice to have children. They feel like their ability to decide what they want to do with their reproductive choices has been taken away from them by how stark they consider the climate crisis to be. There's another group called No Future, No Children, which is a campaign based out of Canada. It was started by a college student at McGill University, and that currently has over 5,000 people who have pledged to not have children until the government takes what they consider to be significant action to combat climate change.
Talking to Danny Blum from the New York Times. Now, Danny, you spoke to a number of people for this article. Is there any one story in particular that stands out?
Yeah, there are a few. I think one of the stories I was most struck by was by a woman who is in her 50s, who has lately been having these really debilitating nightmares about her adult daughter being affected by climate change, either caught in a flood or swept away in a wildfire. And she told me that she used to long for grandchildren. She really wanted her daughter to have a child of her own. And now she is just so grateful that her daughter doesn't have a child and has no plans to have a child. She was just really so concerned by the future.
Wow, that's tough to think that she has shut that part off to just sacrifice that grandparent love. Danny, that to me is sounds like a bad sacrifice to make, but for her it seems okay.
I mean, what she told me was that if she had a grandchild, she would be worried sick every second of the day.
I think I have grandkids, so Danny, I'm worried sick about them all the time, no matter what. But yeah, this is part of it as well. And I also understand that you also got on this story because of what your friends were telling you.
Yeah, when I started at the parenting team at the Times about a year ago, I started having conversations with my friends just anecdotally about their decisions around having children. And I'm 23, so these conversations were happening earlier than they might have. You know, and I just kept on hearing my friends say that they were concerned about the ecological crisis. And a number of them told me they were either considering not having children or had already decided that they didn't want to. And I wanted to investigate whether this was a larger phenomenon. And the more reporting I did, the more stories I found.
When you were talking to all these people, how high is climate change on the list? Because I'll give you an example. I got married when I was 27 years old, and that was a long, long time ago, in the 90s. That's how long ago it was. But if I put 27-year-old me here in 2020, there's a lot of reasons why I probably wouldn't want to have kids. And climate change might be one of them, but also things are expensive. You couldn't afford to buy a house if you're renting somewhere. How high is climate change on that list? Is it number one for most of the people you spoke to?
Among everyone I spoke to, it was number one. For a lot of the people that I interviewed, there was really an aha moment when the UN released a report in 2018 that said that there would be signs of climate change in a really, you know, stronger than anticipated way as early as 2040. And a lot of people read that news and started really reconsidering how that would affect their day-to-day life.
Now, just to play devil's advocate, while I get that there's a lot of people on the planet, it's not a good thing for the Earth itself. A declining population also isn't something that's ideal, too. So especially if we get to a point where there are more older people than younger people, does that play into anyone's thought process at all?
Oh, definitely. It's something that people I talk to consider. They think about it. They understand that argument. But in this case, the fear of bringing kids into an unstable world is something that really trumped that for these people. They really consider the threat that climate change poses to be so great that it outweighs an argument like that.
That's the New York Times' Danny Blum. Danny, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, back in 2006, Matthew Cherry retired from the NFL as a wide receiver. He played for the Cincinnati Bengals and the Jacksonville Jaguars. Then he immediately went to work as a production assistant trying to break into Hollywood. A little while ago, he tweeted or predicted that he had an Oscar-winning idea. That was 4 years ago. It turns out that that idea was Hair Love, the animated short that won him an Oscar just about a month ago. Hear all about it when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. The list of college or pro athletes becoming actors when their playing days are over has plenty of well-known names on it. Think Burt Reynolds, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, Terry Crews. Now, the list of athletes becoming Academy Award-winning producers and directors is a lot shorter. In fact, there's not enough folks to quite make a list, but it is an impressive group. Think about Kobe Bryant a couple of years ago getting that Oscar for his animated short film Dear Basketball. And then last month, former NFL wide receiver Matthew Cherry won in the same category for Hair Love. That's the movie about the challenges one black father faces while trying to help his young daughter with her hair. And Matthew Cherry is joining us now in studio. And Matthew, first of all, you brought a friend with you. Who did you bring? Because that guy is not on the list to be allowed in here.
No. He gets his way into every place he wants to be.
You brought your Oscar. Your actual Oscar.
Yep, brought our friend Oscar with us. Yep.
So since you won, how many places have you taken it to? Is it like the Stanley Cup in hockey where they're taking it just everywhere they go?
No, I've only brought it to a couple places. So the same night that we won, I actually was supposed to start directing a TV show, the show called Mixed Dish for ABC.
Yeah, yeah.
And I stayed up all night. We were doing the after parties and everything, and I had a 7 a.m. call time. And so I had to bring it with me to set the first day that I shot. Not on purpose. I wasn't going to do that.
Oh, come on. No one's going to believe that.
Yeah. But, you know, I had to bring it with me. And then today.
I always said that if I ever once, it'd become my gym card, my keychain. I'd have it on my club card. I mean, I'd take it with me everywhere.
It's pretty heavy.
So let me ask you this, Matt. I mean, just the title, Academy Award-winning filmmaker. It's been, what, a month, month and a half? How has that sunk in for you?
It's insane. You know, it really hasn't had a chance to set in just because I've been kind of working and getting right back into it. But yeah, it's amazing, man. I mean, I think especially when you think of all the people that have come before who were black, who won Oscars, you know, it's a very exclusive list. You know, Spike Lee just got his last year. You know,
Barry Jenkins, not that long ago.
Yeah, Barry Jenkins. You think of, you know, Denzel and Jamie Foxx and Halle Berry and all the greats, Hattie McDaniels, Sidney Poitier, you know, know, it's a very exclusive club, and it's just an honor to be in that same category.
Now, your film, Hair Love, why did you want to make this movie?
You know, Hair Love really was done for a few reasons. You know, the first reason was, you know, back in 2017, I came across a lot of these videos of Black dads that were doing their daughter's hair, and it felt like a really great opportunity to kind of normalize Black fathers. You know, in mainstream media, if you watch a TV show or movies, like, you know, for whatever reason, we always get a really bad rap in mainstream media as being not present in our kids' lives. And so that felt like a really important opportunity. It also felt like a great opportunity to get some representation in animation to showcase a Black family. You know, back in 2017, when we had done this, you know, only at the time, only three movies had featured Black protagonists. It was Bebe's Kids in the 90s. It was Princess and the Frog in the late 2000s. And then there was A Home, that movie from DreamWorks. So that felt like a great opportunity. And even back in 2017, every week, there was a new story. I don't know if you remember that story about the wrestler that they made him cut his locks before the match.
Every week, high school wrestler.
Every week there's, you know, either they make mainstream news or don't, but there's always been a story like that kind of every week where, you know, kids or people at work aren't able to wear their natural hair the way they want to. And so it felt like a great opportunity to try to normalize Black hair as well.
Now, for those that don't know, Hair Love is a story of an African-American family, a dad, mom, and little girl. Mom is sick, so it's up to dad to fix his daughter's hair. And for millions of dads out there, that is a daunting task. But Matthew, why is it especially challenging for Black dads and Black daughters?
I think it's, you know, especially challenging for everyone. But I think for, you know, Black hair is such a iconic, you know, thing that's in our culture. You know what I mean? There's been so many stories that have been done about it. I mean, you think back to the 60s and the 70s, you know, even going all the way back to you know, the first woman who created the natural hairline. You know, it's just been something that's been in our culture for a very long time. And I think to me, it's like really a great opportunity to bond. You know what I mean? Like when you take the time to do your kid's hair, it's a really special moment. And, you know, I think the big thing that we wanted to do with this was also to kind of circumvent these gender roles. You know, in 2020 now, oftentimes both parents work now. You know, rent is super expensive everywhere. And if mom has to go to work early or mom has to go out of town, you know, dad got to step up and you got to get the kids together. You're not going to just let them go to school looking crazy. And so it was just really wanting to represent what that world was.
Now, I think when you watch Hair Love, I think you got to have a heart of stone not to get like a case of the feels. No, it's a really sweet story. Let's listen to a clip of Hair Love.
Just took a little bit of work and a whole lot of love. Mwah. Are you ready to do this? All right, here we go. See? Now, wasn't that easy?
Now, the voice that jumps off the screen there, that's Issa Rae, HBO's Insecure, and the film out to right now, The Photograph. How did you get Issa Rae involved?
I've been a fan of Issa's, man, ever since back in the day with her web series Awkward Black Girl. Yeah. You know, when I reached out to her, she was totally down. You know, Issa's one of the type of people that it's not always about the money. You know what I mean? Like, I think she saw the potential of this to be something that was a strong cultural moment. And she was down to be a part. And, you know, we knocked it out in one day. And, you know, she was in the middle of her writing room for Insecure. And she gave us some time. And we knocked it out. And she was amazing, you know? She has such an iconic voice. And she's also such a champion of the natural hair movement right now, too. It just made perfect sense.
Talking to Academy Award-winning filmmaker
so
Matthew
crazy.
Cherry. I know you love hearing
so
that.
Great. It's
I
crazy,
love saying
man.
It. I'll
it's
say it all day long.
Say that.
Now, you retired, Matthew, from pro football in 2007. Then you started working in production. In 2017, you found yourself at an LA nonprofit, Streetlights. That's a training program for production assistants aimed with diversity in mind. How'd you wind up there and what did you get out of it?
Yeah, man. So, you know, when I was in the league, I remember my second year when I was with the Cincinnati Bengals in 2005, I had come out to L.A. I used to work in radio. I interned at my college radio station and up in a couple of stations in Cleveland. And basically, I came to L.A. for this award show. I had met somebody who was a part of the program. She told me that basically everything that it still is today. It was a nonprofit organization that helped train men and women of color as production assistants and also helped you get your first couple of jobs. And at the time, I had no connections to anything in Los Angeles, and I really needed that foot in the door.
So you really came here with just a dream, mind, and that's it. Just like millions of other Hollywood hopefuls.
Yeah. I retired in 2006, and then you know, I applied to this program, and luckily I got in. You know, it was just great, man.
Now, looking at the Oscars that just happened, the South Korean film, Parasite, took home four major awards. So this year, Oscars weren't so white, but they also weren't that black or brown either. Mm-hmm. As someone who went through the whole process, Matt, how much of that did you feel? in that?
We definitely felt the responsibility. You know, we felt like we had to, you know, really represent. I think our particular year, there were only five, you know, Black people that were nominated. And so, yeah, you feel that throughout the whole process. And, you know, it just felt like an additional responsibility for us to, you know, really represent. You know, I'm really happy that we were able to be a part of, you know, this historic year. You know, I think between us and Parasite and Taika Waititi and then the woman that won for best score, you know, but it can always be better. And, you know, I hopefully I get a chance to become a member of the Academy and, you know, moving forward. And I hope that I can be a part of the change, you know, to help it so that, you know, every year is not the same conversation.
Where does this go for you ideally with your career? What kind of films and stories do you want to make?
You know, for me, I really love this lane of, they call it co-viewing, you know, where you're able to really do projects that the entire family can enjoy. Mm. We're definitely thinking about that moving forward with any television and film opportunities moving forward. You know, I think just things that are positive representations, things that bring joy, you know, things that are educational as well. All the things that made Hair Love successful, we want to try to keep that same energy moving forward.
One more thing, Matthew, because on May 10th of 2016, you tweeted this: any 3D artists follow me? I got an Oscar-worthy short film idea. That idea turned out to be Hair Love,
yep,
the movie that won you Best Animated Short. So since that was a four-year stretch of time, 2016 to 2020, let's pretend you're tweeting right now about where you will be in 2024. What does that tweet say?
I hope that tweet would say something to the effect that, you know, I'm so proud of, you know, these specific filmmakers that I was able to help along their journey to get to the same place. For me, that's the most important thing. I think helping other filmmakers come behind me, be that sharing their project, be that offering advice or assistance, you know, that's something I'm really wanting to do a lot more moving forward, and something that, you know, hopefully moving forward, other filmmakers can feel that support for me as well.
That's Matthew Cherry, Oscar-winning filmmaker for Hair Love. Matthew, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it. Because it's already all right,
yeah. Got a picture of Matthew Cherry's A Visit to Take Two on my Twitter and Instagram. Same address, @AMartinezLA. That's @AMartinezLA. He actually liked the shirt I was wearing. Very rare when someone younger and cooler than me likes something that me, an old fogey, is wearing. There, I'm a fashion influencer now. All right, more Take Two tomorrow at 2. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.